From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And as we like to say, if we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, in 1986, our guest, Frank White, was working on his groundbreaking book, The Overview Effect, Space Exploration and Human Evolution, when he heard the late author Tom Wolfe, author of The Right Stuff, he heard him say, the country has never had a philosophy of space exploration. So this began a continuing quest for Frank to develop a deep understanding of why and how humans should explore the universe. The book we're about to discuss with Frank is The Cosma Hypothesis, and it represents a culmination of White's efforts to develop a space philosophy. The book draws on interviews with astronauts about the way in which spaceflight shifted their understanding of our relationship with the universe. Well, we're really happy to explore this topic with Frank White. He was a Harvard professor for 17 years. He still teaches in Harvard Extension. He was a Rhodes Scholar and the author and co-author of 14 books ranging in topics from space exploration to climate change. Frank White, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Well, you have a very interesting life and set of interests. And I guess I might go out on a limb and say that there aren't a lot of people who have thought about how we should conduct policy and militarization and colonization and everything that we might be doing in space. What's your come from?
Well, my first cousin who grew up with me down in Mississippi in the 50s tells me that I started talking about this when I was around 5 years old. And I told her that we were going to have to leave planet Earth and go live on other planets. And I don't remember that, but I do remember my mother giving me a book about astronomy when I was 10 years old. And I never looked back. I just got very, very interested in spaceflight, astronomy, everything to do with the planets and our relationship to the planets. And so I've been working on that for a long time. But I'd say the key moment came when I was flying cross-country back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I was thinking a great deal about living permanently in space, in a space settlement, let's say. Looking out the window of the plane, I had something of an epiphany where I realized that if you lived in a space settlement or on the moon, you would always have an overview of the Earth. You'd see it in a completely new way. And I called it the overview effect. And I figured it would be a big paradigm shift for humanity. Since there weren't any space settlers, I started interviewing astronauts and found, yeah, something does happen when you're out there. And that's been the foundation on which I started to build this idea of a philosophy of space exploration, because how we think about what we're doing affects our behavior. At this point, we're about to leave the Earth in large numbers. If we don't take this new mindset of the overview effect with us, I'm really concerned that we are going to repeat the mistakes we've made here on planet Earth, where we've mixed exploration with exploitation, often in a damaging way. So philosophy sounds abstract, but it really isn't. It really affects what we do in the world. And these things are being determined right now, today.
It seems that even in recent years, we're still at the place and the point in time that we are trying to figure out how to explore space. And you've gone several steps beyond into when we are at the point that we find a hospitable environment in space in which to settle. I mean, you're looking many steps down the road, it seems to me, but maybe you don't think that. Maybe you think this is the next step, literally.
Actually, I do. I think what is happening is when you have an exponential curve where things start to accelerate dramatically and take off, it seems like, oh, this happened overnight. But actually, it's something that's been building over a long period of time. And in the case of space exploration, it has been building over a long period of time. But we now have what you might call a perfect storm. The private sector is very interested and sees ways to make money in exploring and developing the solar system. Governments, more governments are getting involved. Instead of two superpower space exploration countries, we have many countries who are putting money into this. And we also have a rising tide of interest among individuals. So all of these things are happening at once. And, of course, we can't leave out the investment community. They're putting money into it. And for all these reasons, we're much closer, I think, than people know. And I've often said, you know, I was driving in Boston traffic not long ago, and I was really frustrated by it. And I looked up, there was a bumper sticker in front of me, and it said, "Peace on Mars, ... just thinking ahead." And I had to laugh because I really wanted to meet that person. I think that's where I'm at, and that's where I'm going, is to think ahead. But, you know, the important thing is I don't want my descendants 500 years from now to look back on this period and say, gee, if they'd only thought ahead, we wouldn't have made some of the terrible mistakes that we're now having to fix.
In the late 80s and in the early 90s, after a number of decades of exploration, manned and unmanned, NASA decided to look inward at the Earth, putting up satellites, collecting data, taking pictures. And we had a person from Goddard Space Flight with us as a guest one day, and we were talking about that, and they'd put together a number of vignettes of these pictures, and when you put them together and put them into motion, you could see this Earth breathing. And he said something to me that really affected me, and that was in speaking with an astronaut who was up and had done an EVA during an extravehicular, I forget the last letter. What's the A for? Activity, I guess. In the Gemini program in the 60s, the astronaut told him that looking at the Earth, it looked like a single breathing organism. And at that point there, I said, geez, I would love to learn about other reflections by other astronauts, people that have been able to witness that perspective firsthand. And you've done that in this book and in your earlier book. Can you talk about some of these revelations, including Edgar Mitchell from Apollo 14?
Yeah, there's so much to say. I've interviewed 31 astronauts at this point, personally, and also read a lot of their books. And that idea of the Earth as a living and breathing organism is not uncommon. And it's an important part of the theory that I'm developing, because I'm expanding that to apply it to the universe as a whole. But going back to the view of the Earth, it seems to me that the Gaia hypothesis, which was also advanced in the 60s and 70s, states that and puts that idea out there. But that's a theory. And the remarkable thing about the overview effect and the astronaut report is it's not an intellectual form of knowledge. This is the big difference between you and me and the astronauts. The things that we know intellectually, they know experientially. And this is what makes their report so remarkable. Not all of them had the same description of the Earth. They have many different reactions to it, but some of the common themes are gosh, no borders, no boundaries. It's a whole system. Everything fits. Why are we fighting over petty things? Why are we fighting over borders we can't even see? And, gee, the atmosphere protecting us from the harsh environment of space is awfully thin. We better take care of it. And there are many different reactions. It can all be summed up, I think, in no matter how different we humans are, we're all in this together. In fact, all life on this earth is in it together, and we need to work together. Mitchell is a centerpiece for the new book, The Cosmohypothesis, because I think what he experienced was sort of an extreme form of the overview effect that I called the universal insight. He not only had an experience realizing the unity and oneness of the earth, but he actually had an experience of the same phenomenon for the universe. He really had an experience that when he came back, he could not explain. He talked to some people at a local university, and they said, you experienced samadhi, an experience of oneness with everything. So there are many different experiences waiting for humanity out there, and we can only guess at what kind of changes in awareness and worldview are going to occur as we leave the planet and move out into the solar system.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Frank White, who has written the Cosmohypothesis. It represents the culmination of White's effort to develop a space philosophy. Things are moving pretty quickly. A friend of mine told me the other day that the last battle of the Civil War, Appomattox, which was fought in 1863 with bayonet and cannon and guns, the last battle of World War II was 1945 with atomic weaponry at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Things are moving so quickly. And if you think ahead of where we may be in 500 or 1,000 years, it's really astounding. You make an interesting point, and I'd like you to talk about it a little bit. In your book about SETI looking out for radio signals and those sorts of things, and how receiving radio signals would be really brief in a civilization, maybe 50 to 100 years before they would move to new technology, and how you tie that in with artificial intelligence. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I wrote a book in 1990 about SETI, and I created what I called the White Equation, and I tried to mathematically determine the impact of contact with extraterrestrial civilizations. Of course, that's one of the exciting things about exploring the universe, but examining it later, I realized the equation had one big problem in that there is such a narrow window when communication would really be meaningful. For example, let's just consider that we make contact with a planetary civilization that is even 500 years older than the Earth civilization. And let's just imagine that it's even 100 light years away. So we get a signal from them, and then we send back a response. It will take 100 years to get there. Then they respond to us. It'll take another 100 years to get to us. Meanwhile, they're evolving, and we're evolving, and we maybe could never catch up to them. And if you just imagine us trying to communicate with Earthlings of 500 years ago, what a gap there is. And so you get this feeling that unless there's a really, really unlikely probability of two civilizations that are close in space and close in time, the communication is going to be hard. The other issue is, will they still be on a planet? The other issue that you raised, John, is will they still be organic? There are some people who believe that we are headed towards something they call the singularity. This is the moment when artificial intelligence and robotics surpasses human capability, and the dominant life form on Earth becomes a form of artificial intelligence, which immediately decides there's no point in staying on this planet. I need to move into outer space where there's abundant energy that will keep me going. And so there's a whole line of thought that we should be looking for evidence of AI as we look outward. All of this is speculation. None of it is certain. But I do think that it makes the possibility of contact with extraterrestrial intelligence more challenging than we thought it would be. And it speaks to the Fermi paradox. The great physicist Enrico Fermi said way back in the 50s, he said, if there are so many of them out there, so many extraterrestrials out there, there are so many stars and planets, why haven't we heard from them? It may be they're not there. It may be that they've just moved on to a point where they are not interested in us.
Mm. Frank, you've been talking about space philosophy since the mid to late 80s. But the likes of, as you talked about before, the private sector, the likes of Elon Musk with SpaceX and Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, obviously, they haven't been talking about it for this long. However, you see now that these are your contemporaries, that they're talking about space colonies. The one by Jeff Bezos, I think it was called O'Neill, or it is O'Neill. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of people talking about this. Can you talk about, you know, how that conversation is getting forwarded by, you know, more so by private sector than by NASA, for example?
Yeah. Well, I think an interesting fact about the big three leaders of the private sector in space exploration, which would be Branson, Bezos, and Musk, none of them are really motivated primarily by making money. They are using the private sector capitalist approach to realize larger visions. I interviewed Sir Richard Branson for the third edition of my book. He's very interested in the overview effect. He really sees taking people on these suborbital hops as being tied to the environmental movement. He feels like he is going to be creating more environmentalists by having them experience the overview effect. Mm-hmm. Jeff Bezos, as you say, harkens back to Gerard K. O'Neill. And I was very involved with the O'Neill Movement Space Studies Institute, and O'Neill had a strong environmental component to his vision. One of the things that he has talked about is that we could move heavy industry off the Earth, and we could reduce the impact of humans on the Earth by moving out into the solar system. And Jeff Bezos is following that plan. I mean, he is saying we have to leave the Earth to save it. And what I'm getting at is these folks really do have a philosophy. They it's not an abstract philosophy, but it's a way of thinking about what they're doing. Musk is a little different in that he is worried about the Earth surviving as well, and he calls the Martian settlement Plan B, just in case something goes terribly wrong on Earth. We need another place to live. So, and, you know, it's interesting. I have found in working with new space, private space companies, many of the people in the entrepreneurial space world were inspired by O'Neill, or they mm-hmm. were inspired by Isaac Asimov and science fiction,
right.
Or, if I may say, they were inspired by my book. Many of them are using the private sector approach, but they're actually pursuing a larger vision of humanity's future. And I'm very encouraged by that, because I don't think we're going to be able to do this without the private sector, and the private sector is the one that is going to be most in need of having a guideline or philosophical approach to what we're going to do out there.
Right. It's interesting you say that about Richard Branson, because I have read that the O'Neill colony of Jeff Bezos has received a lot of criticism, saying, you know, you're ignoring the plight of, you know, billions of people or millions, you know, here on Earth. But the whole idea, mm-hmm. and what you and John were speaking about earlier, of looking back at the Earth as a living, breathing entity, makes me think that the more we go into space, the more we are going to appreciate and take our Earth, planet Earth, under our wing and say, let's protect it.
It's not only that, too. I mean, it's also, let's take care of all the people and all the living organisms on the Earth. I think I've never talked to an astronaut where I said, what did you get out of your experience out there? Not one of them has said, my experience was we need to move away from the home planet, start focusing on new things, and don't worry about the Earth. Let's just leave it behind. Every astronaut that I've talked to is more ecologically concerned. They have a more humanitarian viewpoint. There is no one who feels like the migration into the solar system means leaving the Earth behind. That's kind of a misnomer, and I think you're exactly right, Lynn. I really think, and my colleagues that I'm working with, like David Beaver at the Overview Institute, really argue, you know, this new way of thinking is critical to solving these global problems. And if we didn't need a new way of thinking, we probably would have solved them. So space exploration, well, let me just step back and say, we are already in space. The Earth is in space. It's always been there. It always will be. We're the astronauts of Spaceship Earth. So space exploration is not leaving the Earth behind. The Earth is a big part of it. All the people on the Earth are part of it. And again, we could make some big mistakes. We could increase political and social inequities by leaving the planet. We can do a lot of things that would not help the Earth. But one of the great gifts of space exploration is this new appreciation of our home planet.
Just a thought, Frank, a slightly different tact, and we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'll try to be brief. The promise of virtual reality is finally starting to reveal itself. It's broken away from just game-oriented to really doing some good things. If astronauts believe that the Earth looks fragile, it looks like we need to take care of it, and those sorts of things, I could envision a really immersive, well-done virtual reality system set up to try to invoke those feelings from the general public that will never travel to space. What do you think about that?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, not everybody is going to make it into orbit, no matter what we do. And even if the price comes down dramatically, there will still be those who won't be able to go. You're right. And many, many people who are interested in bringing the overview effect down to Earth are actually working on virtual reality as the tool. And my position is that experiencing the overview effect ought to be a human right. Everybody ought to experience it because it tells us where we are and who we are in the universe. And they should either be able to do it by going on one of Richard Branson's flights or through a high-quality VR simulation. So I support both, and I believe there's enough people working on both that this may come to fruition, and we may have millions, if not more, human beings having the experience the astronauts have had.
Well, stay in touch with us on that one, Frank. We'd like to hear more.
Our guest is
I sure will.
Frank White is our guest, and his new book is The Cosma Hypothesis, implications of the overview effect. Glad we had this conversation. I think the world's catching up with you, perhaps, now, Frank.
Well, you know, Lynn, I try to stay a little bit ahead, but I do hope people will catch up, and I appreciate you helping me with that.
All right. Take care, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
And stay with us. We'll be back to talk about the intersection of math and football. This one's going to be a great conversation. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Do you have his